Good evening. I'd like to welcome everyone to Simple Actions, Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. My name is Leanne, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Leanne.
For those who care to join us, let's open the meeting with a spring in your prayer. God,
grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change,
the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
Amen.
The Simple Actions Group wishes to extend a warm welcome to all in attendance this evening. These premises are non-smoking, and our group is welcome to use this room and the restrooms exclusively, which are across the main foyer and up a small flight of stairs. At this time, please silence your cell phones. Also, we respectfully ask that those present please refrain from unnecessary moving around the room. This will keep distractions and disturbances to a minimum and allow everyone to listen uninterrupted. This group practices the spiritual foundations of anonymity, singleness of purpose, and effective sponsorship. As a group, we believe that Alcoholics Anonymous provides alcoholics with a set of clear directions on precisely how to recover from the illness of alcoholism on the basis of simple actions. These actions are contained in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. It is the purpose of this meeting to carry that clear message and to focus on precisely how to recover from the illness of alcoholism on the basis of AA simple actions. The AA preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other. They may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is the desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. And the format of this meeting is an open big book step study. As a group, we recognize the power of one alcoholic identifying with another alcoholic, sharing their experience, strength, and hope from the book Alcoholics Anonymous. We encourage you to engage in conversation and ask questions after the meeting pertaining to the step discussed tonight. And this evening, we're discussing step one. And if you'll help me, please welcome our panel this evening. We've got Jill and David. So we're going to be reading the first paragraph on page Roman numeral 26, XXVI. The physician who, at our request, gave us this letter has been kind enough to enlarge upon his views in another statement which follows. In this statement, he confirms what we who have suffered alcoholic torture must believe, that the body of the alcoholic is quite as abnormal as his mind. It did not satisfy us to be told that we could not control our drinking just because we were maladjusted to life, that we were in full flight from reality, or were outright mental defectives. These things were true to some extent, in fact, to a considerable extent with some of us, but we are sure that our bodies were sickened as well. In our belief, any picture of the alcoholic who leaves out this physical factor is incomplete. The doctor's theory that we have an allergy to alcohol interests us. As laymen, our opinion as to its soundness may, of course, mean little. But as ex-problem drinkers, we can say that his explanation makes good sense. It explains many things for which we cannot otherwise account. And I'm going to turn it over to Jill.
Hi, I'm Jill. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Jill.
My sobriety date is November 10th, 1996, and this is my home group. This was a hard step for me because I didn't believe that I was powerless over an ounce of booze, an ounce of liquid in a glass. I mean, how stupid could that be, right? But this, I've written on the side here, concede to my innermost self. And what I have to concede is, does this apply to me? Do I, when I take a drink, can I just cut it off, just stop? Am I content doing that? Now, I've proven I can do it, but you don't want to be around me when I do it, because after a while, I'm kind of like, The book later on will call it Restless, Irritable, and Discontent. And the thing they talk about with analogy, I thought, you know, I don't get hives. How can that be? You know, I think I know a lot of things that I just don't know. You know, or I've put my intellect on things that just aren't so, is what a friend of mine used to say. An allergy is just an abnormal reaction. I heard a statistic one time, but don't quote me on this because it could be wrong, but 1 out of 10 people is alcoholic. So 9 out of 10 do not have the reaction I have when I take alcohol in my body. When I drink, I want more. I don't think I've ever had a drink that didn't want more. And I didn't start drinking when I was 12, but I when I started drinking, I could never get quite enough. You know, first of all, it was to get a little buzz. And what a little buzz is good. A big buzz must be worth a lot. So let's keep going. But when I drink, I always feel better. I always get this sense of empowerment. Something kicks in. I've heard people say it was like a spiritual awakening. You know, just something major happens in me when I take alcohol. And it's like up here, when it says, people were trying to tell me for years, Joe, you've got a drinking problem. Doctors tried to tell me that, psychologists. Psychiatrist even. One psychiatrist went as far as to say that I had the mind of a chronic alcoholic, and I fired him. I didn't go back there. You know, who wants to hear that stuff? I didn't understand that my willpower couldn't keep me from drinking until all of a sudden it progresses. Alcoholism progresses slowly in me, it did, because for a long time I could stop sometimes. I stopped for a whole year when I moved out to South Hill, Virginia, and became Mother Earth. That was, I did really good that year. Then I stopped for a whole year when I got cancer, and I didn't drink that year. Of course, they had to medicate me because they were sure that I was depressed because I had cancer, and I didn't realize at the time it was because I needed a drink, damn it. It wasn't, you know, the cancer was like a inconvenience. It just didn't have anything to do with why my mood was the way it was. But when they said the body of an alcoholic is quite as abnormal as its mind, I had a tremendous capacity for alcohol, a tremendous capacity. And I thought that was an asset, you know, like I could drink with the big guys. And but all of a sudden what happened to me is as it progressed, and especially in the last stages of my alcoholism, I could never tell you. If I took 2 drinks, I might go into a blackout and things get really ugly fast. Or I could sit and drink all night long and feel like I was sober. I think if you gave me a sobriety test, it would prove I wasn't, but I would feel like I was. So it's like it became very unpredictable with me. But it was always amazing that how could I be an alcoholic? I don't live under the bridge. I'm not drinking Sterno. But one of the things I had to get kind of to grips with was what was I willing to give up for alcohol? I gave up a couple of really good marriages. I walked away from relationships with people. I didn't walk away from a job because I had a little bit of sense left that I did know how I need to have a way to pay for all this. But I was willing to give up anything and anything that got in the way of what I wanted to do. Thanks, that's all I have.
Thanks, Jill. Hi, everybody. I'm an alcoholic. My name's David.
Hey, David. Hey, David.
Grateful to be here and grateful to be sober tonight. This is also my home group. And for those of you who are regular here, you know we don't usually have home group members here. It's typical on our format to invite other people to come in. But people got sick today. So it's a pleasure to be sitting up here with Jill and Leanne, though. I kind of want to just say ditto to everything that you said. I had the exact same thing. I absolutely love the effects of alcohol. When alcohol was doing its job, it was like the missing ingredient in my bloodstream, you know. And I love the feeling of being 10 feet tall and bulletproof, drastically handsome, able to sing. That was great. I loved the effect of alcohol since I was, you know, 12, 13 years old. And I was off and running in earnest by the time I was 15, 16. So some of the things that it talks about in here, like I came up in an alcoholic home as well, and I don't offer that as an explanation. My alcoholism, I see myself as sort of a freeze-dried alcoholic. If I'd have been raised in cotton, you know. And then that first drink hit my system. I was destined to be off and running, no question about it. You know, I fell in love from it from the very start. So, but no, none of those people that I grew up with ever told me that that I was maladjusted to life, or that I was in full flight from reality, or ever told me that I had a drinking problem. You know, they didn't like all the things that I was capable of saying and doing, but nobody ever said, David, you should look at your drinking, because everyone was drinking. So, but I used to ask myself these questions. Why do I do this? Why do I do this? I'm going way beyond the limit. I'm staying out way past the time that I really want to. I'm hanging out with people that I don't even want to be with. And I come to, you know, I need to be separated from alcohol once I go on a run. It's either going to run out, or I'm going to pass out, or there's something I absolutely diehard have to get to, you know. But I end up, an event has to happen to separate me from alcohol. And that's usually falling asleep. But then I would come to, and I would feel terrible. I don't know about anybody. I hear people from the podium say that they drank and they didn't get hangovers. I would make myself so sick with the amount of alcohol I would put. My hair would hurt, you know. My eyeballs would throb. I would, you know, do an inventory in those moments. You know, why do I do this? So you guys tell me that I have this physical allergy, that it's a physical thing. That's it. And I too struggle with allergy. And the thing that really helped me, and so I'll offer it because it really helped me, because I always translated allergy as an adverse reaction, right? And so, like Jill, I have an immense capacity for alcohol. The effects of alcohol are extremely pleasant to me. I don't break out in hives. You know, people, the old timers will say, I break out in handcuffs, you know, ha ha. But it still doesn't explain what's actually going on. And the guy that helped me said it's not an adverse reaction, it's an abnormal reaction. That 9 out of 10 people do not react this way to the substance alcohol. See, that's the other thing. I just assumed that everyone had the same reaction to alcohol that I had. You know, that it was a spiritual experience. And it baffled me that you weren't interested in bottoming up your glass and going to the store and getting another jug with me. No, I'm good. You know, I look at my wife. My wife really enjoys the effect of one glass of wine, and then if she has another one, that already I know she's not an alcoholic because it's an if. She might not, but she'll get about halfway through that and she starts getting an unpleasant experience. She feels out of control. She doesn't like it. She's like, I don't think this is good. Am I going to be okay? All I can tell you is I've never known what that was like. I'm like Jill. I never had a drink of alcohol that didn't want to have another drink of alcohol. So it explains many things for which I can't otherwise account, because I cannot tell you why. Why, David, can't you just have two and go home, call it a night? I would ask myself that question. Why can't I just catch a buzz and go home? See, I had that great obsession that the book talks about. Someday I'm going to control and enjoy my drink, and I'm going to find the right combination of chemicals, days of the week, quantities, brands, environments. You know, I'm going to hide my keys from myself. I'm going to stay home. I'll keep my hands to myself. I would make all these deals trying to manage and control and enjoy my drinking. And what this is telling me is if I light this candle, it's going to burn to the ground. You know, one drink demands another drink. The second drink demands a third drink. And that's a physical thing. It's absolutely beyond my mental control. That explains, if I accept that, it explains all of that. Why I can't control it. Once I start, I can't stop. And I think that's all he's saying. Thanks.
Thank you. All right, I'm going to go over to Roman numeral 28, XXD 111. We believe, and so suggested a few years ago, that the action of alcohol on these chronic alcoholics is a manifestation of an allergy, that the phenomenon of craving is limited to this class and never occurs in the average temperate drinker. These allergic types can never safely use alcohol in any form at all. They once having formed the habit and found that they cannot break it, once having lost their self-confidence, their reliance upon things human, their problems pile up on them and become astonishingly difficult to solve.
The phenomenon of craving. You know, I can remember my ex-husband, my second ex-husband, He was really a nice guy. He really was. He used to say to me, Jill, why can't you just have 4 or 5 beers? Why do you just have to stay there until you're falling down drunk? And it was like, I don't know. That's all I could come up with. I don't know. If it was there and I was still there, I wasn't going to stop. And even if I went home, I wasn't going to go to bed or anything. I was just going to keep drinking. I was going to find some way to keep drinking because it was the most amazing thing. It's like I'd be tired and know that I had to work the next day. I really need to stop. I will after one more. Maybe just one more after that. And then at 4 o'clock in the morning, I finally pass out. You know, I just have this idea that it would just be one, you know, just one more, just one. And it's funny because it's like, I had a book. I had a lot of self-help books, but this one was really a good one. What do you say to yourself when you talk to yourself? And what I would say to myself, I'd practice this before I'd be drinking or something. I'd go, you know, we're going to limit this to 6 tonight. And you're going to be fine with just 6 tonight. And you're going to be okay. And then you're going to go to bed. And you're going to sleep. And I would talk to myself with this. And I'd say, okay, I got it. And then I would have one. And then at 2 o'clock in the morning after this, just a huge amount of, most of a bottle of bourbon or whatever, gone, I'd be sitting there going, just one more. I can do this, just one more. And it was like, this was destroying my life. If I was eating tuna casseroles and they was destroying my life, I would have no trouble. I just wouldn't eat a freaking tuna casserole. But when it came to booze, it was like, mm-mm. I remember I was down in the Bahamas 1 year, and it was on a beautiful, beautiful trip. Somebody invited us. They had an 84-foot boat with a captain and a cook and all that. And then they were doing things like snorkeling for lobsters and going jet skis and all this stuff. And they were just having fun. But I was there for 3 days when I was trying to drink like they were. Have a few here, have a few there. I was coming out of my skin trying to make that work. And I made them fly me home, back to the mainland so I could come home. And when I came home, I stood at the sink with a glass of bourbon. I did this several times. Once I was coming home from the hospital from alcohol poisoning. With a glass of bourbon, just get it down. Okay, I'm okay now. So, I mean, that is that craving, that obsession with this, that no matter what I did, I couldn't leave it alone. And if you try to tell someone that, you know, it's like, well, I don't know why I do that. I do it because I can't not do it. I mean, you're not going to say something dumb like that. I mean, you're going to go, I don't know. None of your business. And stuff like that. Thanks. That's all I have.
Thanks, Jill. Yeah. The action of alcohol on these chronic alcoholics is the manifestation of an allergy, the phenomenon of craving. So he kind of sets those two things equivalent there. That's what he means. The abnormal reaction is this phenomenon of craving. Limited to this class, never occurs in the average tempered drinker. And then it tells me I can't safely use alcohol in any form at all. I don't like that. I'm not particularly interested in using alcohol safely. I like to drink unsafely. I like to throw the cap out the window and roll, you know. I don't care about drinking safely. But when I first, and then talks about their problems pile up on them and they become astonishingly difficult to solve. And I think about when I met you guys. I was 22 years old, and my astonishingly difficult to solve problems had piled up on me. I'd been asked to leave several universities, but this was the most recent. My GPA couldn't keep up with my blood alcohol content. They eventually just ask you to, Mr. Francis, you don't seem committed to this. You know, I'm not. So I'd left a university. I already buried 4 of my friends. You know, that's the other thing. You know, it's like I'm told one out of 10 people suffer from alcoholism, and those people become my friends. You know, because if you and I go out on a Friday night and you get halfway through your second drink and yawn and stretch and say you got a big day tomorrow, we're not going out again. I don't want to hang out with you. You know, I want to hang out with with Kyle, you know. After we close this place, I got a jug back at the house, and, you know, we're going to make, we got a big night on tonight, you know. So those are the people that become my friends, right? And there's a lot of utility in that, because you can look around yourself once you've surrounded yourself with us and say, everybody drinks like this. And I'm not even as bad as that guy, you know. So anyway, you go to some funerals if you're hanging in that. So I'd lost some friends and lost some opportunities, lost some colleges, lost some relationships, things like that. So my problems were piling up on me, and alcohol is starting to do less for me and do more to me. You know, that 10 feet tall, bulletproof, drastically handsome, able to sing response that I was getting from alcohol wasn't delivering reliably, you know. It was still delivering enough to make it compelling, but I was also capable of being violent. Certainly not keeping my promises or showing up places where I was going to show up. It was a good idea that I stopped drinking. It was a good idea that I stopped drinking long before I even entertained the notion of it. But I had no idea that I couldn't do the job myself. So my problems had piled up on me. And of course, any of us, when we come in, we're new. And those of us who work with newcomers, you know, that's what every new man wants to talk about, is astonishingly difficult to solve problems. Nobody gets here on a winning streak, right? You know, there's always finance, busted finance, romance, relationships, all that stuff is, and that's what I'm concerned about. And I think if I can fix those things secretly, if I can get the money right and the honey right and the job right and everything going back in my way again, then I can drink safely or drink without consequence or drink the way I want to drink. These are the kind of fantasies I have. So I had overshot the mark significantly, and I ended up in Alcoholics and in a detox, 72-hour detox at 5 points. And I'm 22 years old, and my arms are black and blue from intravenous drug use. I've been up for 3 or 4 days straight. I'm incoherent. I'm hostile. And you guys start talking to me about AA. And I was like, I don't want anything to do with it. But the thing that you told me, and the reason I'm sorry, I just went on and on and on about all that. But I sat in that meeting, and it was not the attractive group of people I see in front of me. I'm 22 years old, and these people were 137, 8, you know. Some of them were on oxygen. All of them were smoking, you know. I mean, it looked like God's waiting room. Really, it just, it wasn't attractive to me, and I was in that condition. I was just dying, you know. And they said, "Look, if you got alcoholism, once you start, you can't stop, and when you stop, you can't stay stopped." And that's what alcoholism is, David. And the other piece of that is that you can't solve that. You left to your own devices, we'll drink again. And if you come with us and do what we do, we can help you with that. And I'm one of the people that said, "Thanks for the information." And I just kept having to go back out again. And out again and come in, and you guys kept never changing your story. Once you start, can't stop. When you stop, can't stay stopped. And you need help. Simple ideas, right? 6 years going in and coming in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous before I accepted that simple piece. Thanks.
Thank you. We're continuing on Roman numeral 28. Men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. The sensation is so elusive that while they admit it is injurious, they cannot, after a time, differentiate the truth from the false. To them, their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. They are restless, irritable, and discontented, unless they can, again, experience the sense of ease and comfort which comes at once by taking a few drinks, drinks which they see others take with impunity. After they have succumbed to the desire again, as so many do, and the phenomenon of craving develops, they pass through the well-known stages of a spree, emerging remorseful with a firm resolution not to drink again. This is repeated over and over, and unless this person can experience an entire psychic change, there's very little hope of his recovery.
Okay, I'm going to back up for just a moment because it's an important thing that I always try to talk about that I just skipped right over. And that was, these allergic types can never safely use alcohol in any form at all. For me, that's an important piece of this puzzle because when I first came in, I was on some medication that wasn't really supposed to be taken. I'm not here to tell anyone they shouldn't take their medication. Nobody. You've got doctors for that. But I was taking something that really I wasn't supposed to be taking. They didn't know what to do with me when I got sick that year, so they medicated me, thinking, my God, she's a nut. Give her some medication. Well, when you take something that doesn't have, and you don't need it, it doesn't have the results it should have. So for me, alcohol in any form is anything that changes my mood, my mind, has any kind of psychological effect on me. And thank heaven I had a doctor that was really good, because he said I was going nuts on medication. And he said one thing, that I'd stop drinking. He said, you know what? I think we need to get you off all this and see what happens. And it was funny, because it got off and I was fine. I mean, I was a drunk and I was trying to get sober, but I was a lot less crazy than I was when I was trying to take something that I didn't need. So alcohol in any form to me is anything that I find myself not being able to live without. If I'm grasping hold of something, you know, I might be wanting to talk to my doctor a little bit about why am I taking this, what am I doing, you know, what effect is having on me. And I just throw that out because that's my experience. I'm not saying that should be anybody else's, but boy, was it mine. And so I really am careful today what I'm putting in my body, because I can do things to sabotage myself without realizing it if I'm not aware. And that means that when someone gives me something, tells me I need to take something, I do a little research and I try to find out what the alcohol in any form might be in this case. It says, men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. I love the effect produced by alcohol. People used to tell me, Joe, you're wound up tighter than a tick. You give me a few drinks and I'm a barrel of laughs. I know I don't look it sometimes, but I'd be just mellow and just really to slide right into a groove there. Of course, I could overshoot that mark and become a lot of other things too. Very argumentative. There was a lot of things that could happen. But the whole thing was, is it did, it had a profound effect on me because I loved the effect of it. You know, if I didn't like the effect, why was I doing it? And after a certain number of years of drinking, I wasn't getting that effect. And when I finally quit, got to the point where I quit, I was drinking just to drink. I was always trying to get a feeling. And once in a while, that's a great lie about this whole thing, once in a while I'd get a little bit of it. You know, a little bit of that ease and comfort, that something. And then I'd chase it some more. And one night I was coming home over in Portsmouth, and this really had jolted me. There was an old man who rode a bicycle, had always had two bottles of beer in a brown paper bag. And one night he fell off the curb with his bike and his beer fell on the ground and broke. And he was sitting on the side of the road. He wasn't hurt. He was crying because he broke his beer. And I knew exactly how he felt. I thought, how much more devastating can you be that would ruin your whole day, that you'd be sitting there crying over that? And I knew what that was. I knew how that felt, because when I was dry, when I wasn't drinking, all I could do is wait until I could go home and have the first drink. And if I couldn't do that, it was a strangest feeling inside of me. It was like too crushing, too. You know, that's the obsession. We'll get to that later. But when they talk, if we succumb again to the desire is there, and it's always to get back this what I had when I first started. You know, the desire is always there. That's why I would always say it's going to be different this time. I came in 94, and I didn't stay because I couldn't understand what y'all were talking about. I thought, you know, This is crazy. I've been too hasty. I'm not that bad, you know, because I didn't understand what you were saying about how that the demoralization that comes from drinking like I did. And alcoholism progresses so fast. At some point, you know, I drank a lot of years without a whole lot of repercussions, without a whole lot of where I was getting ease and comfort. You know, boy, we're just getting it on. But after a while, there was like a fog that settled over me. That even when I was drinking, it wasn't fun, but I was doing it because there was a chance, just a chance, that something would feel good in there. And it was very short-lived, most usually. And it was, when they talk about the ease and comfort, it was something that I chased and chased and chased. I used to say, you know, I rode that pony to death. And I did. And it was just, it was dead. But I still couldn't stop. If you told me that you need to be sober, your mom's dying, you know, it's like I would have had drinks on the way there, left and had drinks more. And, I mean, that couldn't have stopped me. So, and it didn't stop me. The phenomenon of craving develops, and they were talking about it. We emerge into the well-known stages of esprit, emerging remorseful, with a firm resolve not to do it again. That firm resolve, that was what I did when I was reading that book, what to say when you talk to yourself. Anyways, it didn't work. But I would get so remorseful over this sometimes. I'd feel almost suicidal sometimes, like, I can't go on like this. And then Bill W. talked about his story about that fierce determination would come back. By God, I'll lick this tomorrow. Not today. And then I was bothered by the phrase I read in here. And this was repeated over and over. You know, unless a person can experience an entire psychic change. And I am not into that new age crap. We're not doing that. And my sponsor was so good. She says, that just means change your mind. That's all that means. You know, there's so much in here I thought I already knew, or that I really had a good grasp on what all these words meant. And coming into AA, not having a dictionary, got in my way for a while, because a lot of it wasn't what I thought it was. But the psychic change was, I was in AA, just coming and kind of hanging around. And I felt like, well, it can't be that hard. I'm looking around the rooms going, well, you got it. It can't be that hard. So I figured I'd get it by just being here and listening to what you said, not really doing anything, not really surrendering to the process. And I was in AA for a while. And I was coming back from Suffolk one night, and I was looking at a tree on Route 58, just coming down that highway. They got a lot of big trees, thinking, you know what? I could run my car into one of these trees, and it wouldn't be as bad as what I feel. Because I hadn't changed. I hadn't let the process even do anything in me. And that was when I realized that if this didn't work, if AA doesn't work, because I'd tried so much, I was out of luck. So why wouldn't I try this? You know, and that's the mind of an alcoholic. If I can't think it up, it's not any good. And it's like, for me to have surrendered to that, that was a monumental thing, just for that moment. But I keep remembering it today, because I remember every little thing that has broken through that barrier that I have, broken through my alcoholism, let's call it what it is changed me a little bit. Every time it just changed me a little bit more, a little bit more. And it makes all of this a little bit more palatable. And it's like, this is going to save my life, and I'm debating it. You know, that's kind of crazy. It's kind of crazy. Thanks.
Yeah, I really always fancied that the reason I do these things to myself is for some deep down psychological, it's got to be a very complex, ornate psychic problem that comes with me. And if I could just figure that out, I love what you said about the self-help books. I used to love the feeling of coming home from Barnes & Noble with a bag full of self-help books, you know, and imagine how good I'm going to feel after I read them, you know. And I got a friend of mine who says all my self-help books are piled up on the side of the bed with highball rings around them. never quite get off the ground. But the only explanation that it offers in here, it just says men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. And that's what the old-timers would say. Yeah, you do it because you like it, David. That's it. It doesn't just say alcoholics. It just says human beings. Men and women drink because they like the effect produced by alcohol. That's it. When I met you guys and I screwed down my willpower at age 22, I put the plug in the jug one day at a time. I'm not going to drink. I'm not going to go to your dumb, stupid little 12-step program. I don't need your phone number. I'm not getting on oxygen today. And I will solve this thing. I will, because I thought that drinking was the problem, right? If I have a drinking problem, then not drinking will be the solution, right? So I didn't drink, and I didn't go to meetings either. What this describes down here, this describes alcoholics, not just men and women. Alcoholics, when I'm not drinking, this, I don't know about anybody else, but this is my resume. I am restless, irritable, and discontent. That is my default mode. I wake up that way, you know? And I've come to learn that a lot of that for me is just sheer terror. I am deep down scared to death that it isn't going to go my way. Things aren't going to work out. I'm going to die broke, alone, unloved, you know, friendless, pitiless, without resource. It's just not going to go my way. This is kind of how I greet the day, you know. And so as I walk around and I'm restless, I'm irritable, I'm discontent. Even, you know, what's wrong, David? Nothing. You know, there's nothing wrong, but it's just not quite right. You know, it's just almost good. But, you know, maybe if she or if it or if the weather, maybe more money, something's going to put me over the top, and then I'll be able to say everything's cool, you know. But I never get there, no matter how much money it is or how pretty she is or how I never get there. I'm restless, irritable, discontent. This is my default mode when I am not drinking. So I spend a year like that, just not drinking. How you doing, David? I'm not drinking. Yeah, I know. No, you mentioned that. How are you doing? I just told you. Because I really, all I want is to get that sense of ease and comfort. I just want to get ripped out of the frame, fallen down. I want some relief from me. I got to get out of my own skull for a minute, you know, and that's what I think alcohol is going to do for me. Otherwise, I'm going to lose my mind. I told him that in that first AA meeting. I said, this is all right for you people, but I reserve the right to check out chemically from reality or I will lose my mind. And I think they said something like, keep coming back, you know. But I must have believed that, otherwise I wouldn't have said it. But that must have been a belief of mine. So I never been hospitalized. I've been hospitalized for the consequences of alcohol, you know, accidents and stitches and broken bones and things like that. But the night I went out after that year of sobriety with no help, I put so much in me so fast, I hospitalized myself. I mean, I ended up in the hospital poisoned, you know, day one out the door. Just once I made that decision, it was like, it's on. So these well-known stages of a spree, I don't know, the details of them are all different for each one of us, but, and I didn't go, I had another 6 years of drinking after that. I wish I could tell you, I woke up, this had to be stopped, you know, but I didn't. I just throttled it back again, you know, went back to the management and control program. And I don't have your sponsor, but I had the exact same old timer, the exact same guy who said, you drink because you like it, David. He said, psychic change is just a fancy way of saying changing your mind. And then he let that sink in for a minute, and he says, and he looked right at me, he goes, and you know how hard it is to get an alcoholic to change his mind? And I knew who he was talking to. I was like, yep. Because I got my own ideas, you know. You guys are nice and everything, but I got my own ideas about stuff, and I don't part with them easily. Silkworth never gives us the roadmap for the psychic change, but I'm told it's numbered 1 through 12 later, practical program of action to bring about the psychic change. It's not a mysterious thing, but it sounds awfully intimidating, doesn't it? Psychic change. So, I'm also one of those people who quit and quit and quit and quit and quit. You know, that I never put together more than that 1 year that I just described, but there was significant periods of sobriety in there in that next 6 years. 3 months here, 3 weeks there, 3 hours over here, but I always had a firm resolution not to do it again. I would always come out remorseful. I don't know about y'all, but I never came out of a blackout in a soup kitchen, you know, doing charity work or helping little old ladies across the street. It was always violent and disgusting and weird, and you know, I don't know why, you know, because I'm a nice guy, I value those things. I don't know why you don't just get drunk and go do charity work. I never did. I got a big mouth, I like to shoot it off. I got my ass kicked a lot is what I'm trying to say. So I would come off of those things every time. This has got to stop. I can't live like this. I'm not going to do it anymore. And then I put the plug in the jug, and then the clock's just ticking until I decide I'm going to do it again. And I fly the same flag. It's going to be different this time. Thanks.
We're going to continue on Roman numeral 29, XX1X. I do not hold with those who believe that alcoholism is entirely a problem of mental control. I have had many men who had, for example, worked a period of months on some problem or business deal which had to be settled on a certain date, favorably to them. They took a drink a day or so prior to that date, and then the phenomenon of craving at once became paramount to all other interests, so that the important appointment was not met. These men were not drinking to escape. They were drinking to overcome a craving beyond their mental control. There are many situations which arise out of the phenomenon of craving which cause men to make the supreme sacrifice rather than continue to fight.
When I read this, I thought it just popped in my head about what that was like. I was working on a term paper. I was taking some classes at Wesleyan. I was working on paper, and I just decided to have a glass of wine. It would be okay, you know. I could keep my focus and do that. And what happened at the end of that was I dropped out of the class. I just dropped out. This is too hard. I'm not going to finish this. It was more important to drink than it was to finish something. And something that would have helped me, something that would have been good, and it was, and that was over and over and over to do that. My list of things that I wouldn't do got much smaller the longer I drank. I hung out with a lot of people that drank a lot. One of my friends, we actually had a chauffeur because he couldn't trust himself to drive, and we thought it was a big deal. Laughed about it. And I said, we weren't companions to each other. We were just drinking buddies. You know, that's all it was. It wasn't any kind of relationship. It was just going through motions so that I could do what I wanted to do. And afterwards, I think of fun I've had in my life, and it was not in any of those years. None of that stuff was fun. But it was stuff that I kept telling myself that I was in the stream of life. Hmm. Oh, yeah, right. And I can remember, because I love these people, because they go, yo, sugar, you can't be an alcoholic. I drink a lot more than you do. And I would just love it, because, you know, that's right. But it's, you give up a lot. You give up a lot to drink like I did. And when they say the ultimate, the supreme sacrifice, what is a supreme sacrifice? It's giving up a marriage that was really good. Because in my mind, that was just the pits. You know, I need to get out of here. I need to get out of here and get a life. And really what it was is I got to get out of here so I can drink without someone harping at me. Someone that cared about me. That would say, Joe, what are you doing to yourself? Can't you see what you're doing? I didn't want anyone pointing that out to me. I didn't want anyone to show me what I was doing. You know, then I might have to do something about it. I can remember a psychologist I went to for quite a while, long time, and finally she says to me, you know, Jill, you don't have to come back. You don't have to come back anymore. I said, why? I'm still paying you. What's wrong? I'm not fixed yet. She goes, I can't help anyone that won't help themselves. So drinking was more important to me, and I couldn't hear what these people were saying until all of a sudden one day I knew it was getting worse. It was never getting better. And I was dying of alcoholism. I got to see myself for who I really was that day. And it was nothing, nothing like, oh, you look at what the advantage you're being given. I thought, damn, there's got to be another solution. There's got to be something else I can do. And it wasn't. There was nothing else I could do. And it was funny because when I look at all this, it's like the phenomenon of craving. It's like, if I'm not drinking, what will life be like? That scared the tar out of me, not to be able to drink anymore. What am I going to do? Where are all these friends going to be? You know? They're going to be still, most of them are still drinking, by the way, the ones that haven't died. But I had to keep doing that. And it was like, I did it until all of a sudden something came through me. And I said I never prayed. I didn't believe in God when I got here. And years after I'd been here for a while, I was clearing out an attic because I was moving. And I found this book of prayers. And I can remember saying a prayer. It's like, God, please help me. And when that happened, something woke up in me a little bit, enough. I came out of enough of a stupor to be able to realize what was happening and to get some help. But when I think of the supreme sacrifice, rather than continue the fight is just, I do whatever it takes to stay sober today. And for a long time for me, that was, because I was such a hard head, I would just white knuckle it. And so I could say I would did it myself, you know. It's like there's some kind of virtue and conquering this by yourself. And when I realized I wasn't going to be able to do that, I could ask for help. That was when I could stop fighting. I could stop trying to make myself be sober, because I can't be sober. But I could surrender to a process that changes me from the inside out. And I love this. This the doctor's opinion has always been important to me, but I always told myself, the biggest lie I told myself is, there's nothing I can't do if I put my mind to it. Nothing. But I couldn't beat alcohol. I could not drink. So that's all I have.
Yeah, that's exactly it, man. You know, he talks about, I don't hold with those who believe alcoholism is entirely a problem of mental control, and I desperately wanted it to be a problem of mental control. You know, if I could just make decisions, I'm a smart guy, you know. I can figure stuff out. I've done a lot of cool stuff, you know, and I'll just figure it out. I'll figure it out. That's my running game. And every time I'm trying to figure it out, I lose, right? The new plan, the new recipe, the new days of the week, all that stuff just fails. Because the guy who goes into a bar to have two drinks, you know, the guy at the bar with two drinks in him is a new guy. He's going to rewrite the deal. Thinks that other guy's a wimp, right? So there's all kinds of examples of where the phenomenon of craving became paramount to all other activities, you know. Not too many dramatic ones. I mean, the one time I was supposed to be a guy's best, I was honored with being the best man at this guy's wedding, and I went on a toot a couple of days before, and I don't really need to show up at that. A lot of traveling involved, you know. I just kind of blew this guy off completely, and then I went and then I hid, you know. Most of it was just just a series of broken promises. You know, if I take a drink, it doesn't matter that I told you that I'd be home at 8 o'clock. You know, you expect me to be home at 8 o'clock. I gave you my word. I believe a man should keep his word, but I'm drinking. So that becomes paramount to all that other activities. So for me, there's just a huge resume of just broken promises. You know, I already enumerated the relationships, the jobs, the university opportunities, you know, that took a back seat to me, you know, getting to feel what I want to feel. So the supreme sacrifice, the way what that looks like for me is suicide. What that looks like for me is 6 months abstinent of alcohol, 28 years old. I still don't want to go to AA. I don't want your little program. I still don't want your phone number. I don't believe in God. And I'm not drinking. And I desperately do not want to drink anymore. I had that. I had the desire to stop drinking. And I knew intuitively that if I started drinking, that I didn't know where I was going to end up. You guys told me that, but now I believed it. And you guys didn't teach me that. You gave me the information, and alcohol taught me that. You know, by this time now, I know I'm 6 months absent, and if I light this candle one more time, I don't know where I'm going, and I'm sick of going where I've been. I don't want to do this anymore. Everything in me does not want to drink anymore. I have a desperate desire not to drink anymore, to live that way anymore, do those things anymore. To my soul, I do not. And just as strongly as I don't want to drink anymore, I know that I'm about to get drunk. I know what that feels like. I'm just like one broken shoelace away from getting drunk, you know? I'm kind of wanting to pick a fight with you so you'll say something to me so I can do what I want to do. So that wasn't like an afternoon. That was like 3 months of just white knuckle, teeth grinding. I'm not drinking and I'm not going to drink, but God, I want to drink. So I ran all that through my computer and it said, why don't you just kill yourself, David? And I thought about that. That seemed like a sparkling idea. And I decided to jump off a building would be the way to do that. And when you're shopping buildings to jump off of, you have to be careful because you don't want one that's too short, you know, because you might come away from that not being able to bend your elbow like the Tin Man and, you know, oil me. We can't have that. And then if it's too high, I might have to spend a significant period of time, you know, regretting my decision. And then I'd be uncomfortable, and I don't like being uncomfortable. These are the things I'm thinking about. These are my meditations, if you will. And then something just said, why don't you go to one more AA meeting, David? Why don't you just go to one more AA meeting? And I went to the We Believe group Wednesday night, 7 o'clock at DePaul Hospital. It used to be Norfolk Psychiatric. All I know is I walked into that meeting. I've been to hundreds of AA meetings, and I don't know what was different about me, if there was even anything different about me, but I know that somebody stuck their hand out and welcomed me, you know, and made me feel comfortable in the room and assured me that nobody was going to call on me. I'm thinking, how does he know what my worst fear is? So these are my meditations, and I sat in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and for the first time I heard what you guys were saying. You know, I heard your stories, and I had no doubt that you guys had been where I'd been, and you'd done what I'd done, and more importantly, you felt like I felt. You had the same excitement and exhilaration of alcohol, and you had the same restless, irritable discontent, the same shame, the same guilt, the same desire to quit, the same frustration. You felt the same way sober as I felt. So I was able to make a decision that day just from that welcoming. I don't know. I can only explain it by grace of God. But I remember sitting in that chair and I thought, I'm going to do what these people do. I'm going to go where they go. I'm going to shut up and do what they do because I don't have a better answer. So lots of my friends made the supreme sacrifice. And I was strongly considering it when I got here. Thanks.
Thank you. I've got one more paragraph. And then if y'all want to share. We're going to continue Roman numeral 30, XXX. All these and many others have one symptom in common. They cannot start drinking without developing the phenomenon of craving. This phenomenon, as we have suggested, may be the manifestation of an allergy, which differentiates these people and sets them apart as a distinct entity. It has never been, by any treatment with which we are familiar, permanently eradicated. The only relief we have to suggest is entire abstinence.
Okay, I make this real short because this is a question I ask people when I'm working with them. When you start drinking, can you stop? You know, and you know, people go, I don't know if I'm an alcoholic. I say, well, there's only one way to find out is when you start drinking, can you stop? And can you, when you do stop, are you okay? You know, if I have a drinking problem, I would just stop, go on, and live this wonderful life. I stop, and the circus begins. And so that's kind of like why I know I belong here with all the other nuts. Thanks.
Yeah. I like being separate and apart as a distinct entity. I like that. But, you know, that, and it goes to identification too, because we all, the details of all our stories are different, right? What we drank and how we drank and whether we used drugs or not, or whether we were weekend warriors or whether we drank every day, you know, whatever. I could keep going, but we all have different details. We get here at younger ages and older, we all have different stories, but this says we have one thing in common. We can't start drinking without developing the phenomenon of craving. Everybody who's an alcoholic has that. If you have one, are you going to have two? And that's the question that I ask too. You know, we will work with the guys in treatment, you know, and I'll say, you think you're an alcoholic? Well, I don't know, you know. Say, well, if you have one, are you going to have two? And the 9 out of 10 response is, oh man, if I have one, it's on. You know, and then the 10 out of 10 responses, no, I really can take it or leave it. And to which I quickly say, well, you don't sound like an alcoholic, which if they're an alcoholic, they can't stand to be excluded. So they start making a kid. Well, you know, anyway. So that's the one thing that we all have in common. One drink's going to have two, two's going to have three. And the good news is there is a solution, and we're going to talk about that in the weeks to come. But it, you know, it's important. The problem is so important, because until I accepted that I had this problem, your little cute little 12-step solution that was academic and interesting, but not really for a guy like me, you know, until I accepted that I actually do have this thing. I've got alcoholism, not a drinking problem. And the good news is I've taken the steps and I'm not interested in taking a drink today. I'm not fantasizing about it. I get to go anywhere free men go, get to raise my children in peace, get to go broke slowly. It's awesome. Thanks.
Thank you. This time we're going to pass the Seventh Tradition Basket. Seventh Tradition states every A group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. While contributions cover each group's rent and other expenses, the Seventh Tradition is essential at every level of AA service. It is both a privilege and a responsibility for groups and members to ensure that not only their group, but also their intergroup, central office, local services, district area, and the general service office remain self-supporting. This keeps AA free of outside influences, which might divert us from our primary purpose, to help the alcoholic who still suffers. The amount of our contribution is secondary to the spiritual connection that unites all groups around the world. And at this time, are there any AA-related announcements? Okay. Simple Actions is a home group. If you're interested in joining our group, please see one of us after the meeting. Will all home group members please raise your hand? Okay, just see one of us if you're interested in joining our group. Newcomers, is there anyone in the first 30 days of sobriety? If you could just give us your first name, we just get like to get to know you and welcome you.
Hi, I'm Arrington, alcoholic.
Hi, Arrington. Arrington.
Welcome.
Hey,
welcome.
Come back,
yes.
Hey, Matt.
Welcome.
Welcome.
Okay. There is literature available. We've got literature over on the table. Pamphlets are free. There's some newcomer packets over there. Please take one of those. Those of you that raised your hand, it's got a meeting list in there. And the books have a price written in the front, and you can see me or one of the group members after the meeting if you'd like to buy a book. And sponsorship. Sponsorship in AA is yours for the asking. We urge you, do not delay. Anyone willing to be a sponsor, please raise your hand. And if you have questions or would like additional information about sponsorship in AA, we have Lygia and Jill, who will be standing up here to ask, answer any questions you may have about sponsorship. Just see them after the meeting. They'll be up here next to the table. And a reminder, smokers, please use the butt can provided outside and stay well away from the church doors. All meetings are audio recorded, and our upcoming events are posted on our website, simpleactions.net. So if you would like to go back and listen to them speak, you can go to the website, simpleactions.net, look at audio, and all of our speakers are there since we started the meeting, so you can go through and listen to them. In closing, I'd like to ask everybody to help me thank Jill and David. Thanks to all who participated. After we clean up, all are invited and encouraged to continue the conversation on the step discussed tonight at the meeting after the meeting, which will be held at Plaza del Sol. It's on Colonial and 22nd Street. It's a Mexican restaurant, and we go out there after the meeting. Did you have something?
I don't know why, but I'll wait.
Okay. And let's see, volunteer. Do you have a volunteer to read the last two paragraphs on page 164?
BJ.
I'm BJ. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, BJ.
BJ.
Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask Him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously, you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with Him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to Him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then.
Okay, and we'll form a circle for those who would like to join the Lord's Prayer.
Thank you.